Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello Rank Squad and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite transatlantic football podcast, and today we're looking back after the conclusion of the domestic season, giving out some awards and talking about the players who've made it, those who have fallen short, and the managers that have got them there as well. My name is Jack Collins and I'll be your host today, and joining me across the water all the way from San Diego, it's Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Hello mate. Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, season over, and I guess when you look back, particularly at the Premier League, it's shaken out that we've ended up with a top four that was quite predictable, but probably not in that order. So in that sense, like, if you could have fast-forwarded and just seen the table, you'd have been like, oh, well, yeah, a little bit weird, but yeah, kind of makes sense. But given the journey we've all been on to end up with this top four, particularly, well, Liverpool obviously ran away with it, but then the teams below Arsenal in third and fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh, and how they've kind of shuffled up on the final day. It was dramatic. It was exciting. It wasn't the best final day I've ever seen, but there were bumps in the road for some teams, and others have had quite a nice ending, like Manchester City, where it's ended as well as it possibly could have, given where the state they were in at one point, and not even looking like they might make the Champions League, as I predicted on this very podcast. So congrats to them. Congrats to everybody that's got something to celebrate. And I guess we can use the next hour to, hand out some flowers to people.
Yeah, we'll hand out some flowers. We'll also talk a little bit about some of the letdowns as well. We've got five categories to look at: a new player of the season, manager of the season, club of the season, letdown of the season, and signing of the season. Dean's going to be covering the Premier League, and I'm going to talk about the rest of Europe on that case. So we'll go on a case-by-case basis for those ones. But before we do that, Dean, I kind of just wanted to talk about some of the best stories of the season, because it has been a year of magnificent things. We've talked about some of the teams ending trophy droughts, sometimes in some cases ever, first ever trophies, but long waits as well. We've seen some magical moments across the board. What's your story of the season? And I'll run through some of the fun ones after that.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to overlook this, but what Nottingham Forest have achieved is pretty special. And it's probably tainted a bit because they did miss out on the Champions League right there on the final day when they've lost to Chelsea. But at the end of the day, they have defied expectations. In pre-season, for most people, they were either predicted to come in the bottom three or to narrowly miss out on relegation and just about stay up. But they went through remarkable spells within the season in terms of winning streaks. At one point, we flirted with the idea, could we see another Leicester City? Could Nottingham Forest be that good? And it was always a big ask, because the season that Leicester obviously won it, there wasn't a team as good as Liverpool or Arsenal, really. So that was always going to be a big ask, and perhaps the ceiling was always going to be third place. And it's remarkable that they were even in third place for as long as they were. They've qualified for European competition for the first time in almost 30 years. And you've seen Chris Wood, mate. Chris Wood is one of the stories of the year. This is a player. I'll be honest, mate. If you'd have asked me in August, what do you think of Chris Wood? I'd have said, not a lot. I don't really rate him. I don't. And I'd have been, I think I even might have said it on Patreon. I think at one point I was like, there's nothing remarkable about this guy. I'm surprised he's actually still playing in the Premier League. There's just like, there's not a defining trait as a 33-year-old that I can see why he's worth having in the Premier League at this point. Well, he shot me down in flames, mate. 20 goals in the Premier League for Chris Wood. Like, it was remarkable. He actually probably saved my FPL season, because there was a stage where I was like, I'm just jumping on him. This guy's on form. I'm getting on Chris Wood. And people were like, nah, that's a flash in the pan. That can't continue. But it did continue for quite a while. There's one stage where he got like half of their goals or something to account for throughout the season. Obviously, like, they weren't always beautiful to watch, Nottingham Forest, but they had a set pattern of play. They had a set 11 pretty much. And it gave everybody hope that you can still compete in this league, because we haven't seen that much recently, and we haven't believed that as a smaller club, say us, for example, at Fulham, that you could break in to be in this kind of category. Fulham have had a great season. We finished 11th. Got a points record in the Premier League. Finished 11th. And you've seen Nottingham Forest here knock on the door of the Champions League places and, yes, end up in the Conference League, but still have had a season that the fans that followed it will never forget. And obviously, it could have been even better in the cup competitions. They had chances of getting to Wembley, and they'll probably feel like maybe that's where the season let them down. Maybe they could have had a cup final appearance at Wembley. That would have probably been the icing on the cake for what they've gone through across this season. But this is a traditionally great English club, and they've actually managed to punch above their weight in the here and now to show everybody that they're not gone forever. And obviously there's been little subplots along the way, and obviously their owner's a bit different from other owners. But even that, and even the scenes of the day when he kind of had shouted at his own manager on the pitch, it was like, well, he cares. And yeah, it might not be everybody's cup of tea, the way that he's so passionate and outspoken, but it's 10 times better than what we see from most other owners out there. And then he bans Gary Neville as well, which a lot of people would have liked too. So, I could say a remarkable season. It obviously would have been truly remarkable if they've made the Champions League, but I'm still going to put it in that bracket because this was a team that people had going down, and they competed with the big boys all season.
Yeah, I mean, they were remarkable, right, over the course of it. And even to finish in the European places is a massive, massive achievement within itself, right? Like, we spoke about this on our Postbox episode on Patreon, but like the idea that if you'd given Forest fans European football at the start of the season, they would have snapped your hand off for it. I think that sometimes is the frustration with these things, that, you know, outcome bias, the fact that they were actually in those Champions League places and it ended up falling away changes the way that it's viewed. But it shouldn't in some ways, because you kind of look at it and think, okay, yeah, the end of the season wasn't great. I'm sure Forest fans had major ideas and were hoping that this was going to be their year and their big moment. But actually, in terms of how this struck out, to even be back in European football is something truly, truly remarkable. And I think that in itself deserves its flowers. So I'm delighted for Forest. I'm delighted to have seen them in there. Look, this is a strategy that was risky. They threw a lot of money at the wall to see if it would stick. And ultimately, they've come up trumps. And look, this isn't a fairy tale. They've spent a lot of money. They've breached spending limits. And those things should be taken into account. But still, you have to make sure that you're doing things in the right kind of way. And when you actually end up with a team this cohesive, that's this good defensively under a wonderful manager in Nuno Espirito Santo, who will be in the conversations, I'm sure, later on in the podcast, then that deserves its flowers in its own right. And I'm delighted in that regard that you can look at it and say that has been a major success story from this season. Forest getting back to Europe in and of itself is a huge, huge achievement. So I'm glad you talked about it. Taking it away from the Premier League for a minute, and there have been so many brilliant stories over the course of this season, right? And look, I spoke a couple of weeks ago about Celta Vigo's rise to Europe and Claudio Giraldez, which has been absolutely magnificent. Seeing them back in European competition is going to be incredible. And that young core of players is such a good feel-good story from this season. You look at Palace winning the FA Cup, you look at Newcastle winning the League Cup, Bologna winning the Coppa Italia, their first silverware in like 50 years. Go Ahead Eagles in the Netherlands winning the KNV Becker, their first silver in like 100 years. Hamburg getting back to the Bundesliga after a 9-year absence and doing it under a local coach and with a kind of journeyman group of players is an incredible story in its own right. And it's going to bring some incredible things back to the Bundesliga next season. We're going to get the Hamburg derby. We're going to get the Nord derby. That's all incredible. But I think my favorite story of the season might be Valencia and Carlos Corberan turning things around at Valencia. He took over with the club in the relegation battle, right in the thick of it, in the relegation zone. And he has lifted them so far clear of that. They finished 12th in La Liga in the end, 46 points, and sort of six clear of the relegation zone. But it was done and dusted a couple of weeks ago in terms of how it kind of stayed out. But you look at his record since he came in there. He went back to his childhood club. He leaves the championship and he goes to La Liga and he's a local boy coming back in. He lifts them clear almost immediately of what's happened here. And you look at his record, 24 matches in charge, 11 wins, 7 draws and 6 losses across all competitions. For a team that really looked like they might be in the thick of it, who really looked like this might be finally the year that they're doomed. In a club where the fan base and ownership is consistently at odds, who have an incredible array of young talent, but haven't been able to kind of really harness it in the way that people would have wanted, who have been in such a difficult situation financially with the stadium, et cetera, for such a long time, period of time now. So that record, you know, those he's basically effectively got 40 points in the 24 games. Now those 24 games are in all competitions, so it's slightly different, but let's just take it as a record. That would equivalent, it would be about 1.67 points a game. If you did that over the course of the season, Valencia would have 63 points. That would have got them sixth.
Whoa.
That would have got them Europa League place. So he's had them in European form since he has come back to the club. That is truly, truly remarkable, considering where they were before he took over, considering the constant fluctuations, considering the transfer regulations with which they find themselves, the constraints placed upon a manager. To be able to put it out in this kind of regard, and especially because, you know, you lose one of your first games in charge, 7-1 to Barcelona, and then you lose another one in the Copa quarters, 5-0 to Barcelona, in the first sort of 4 weeks of his tenure. That is not the kind of thing you bounce back from easily. But yeah, they've had some incredible, incredible results over the back half of the season. Just like sort of 2 losses in their last like 10 games, I think it was. Okay, a few too many draws, but they beat Real Madrid in that time. They get some really, really important results across the back of it. And, you know, the only teams they lose to are an Athletic Club who have been fantastic all season long and an Alaves who were scrapping for their lives at that point. You have to go back before that to February, the last time that Valencia lost a game under Carlos Corberan. That is an incredible run. Through all of March and all of April and into the start of May, they have gone this absolutely incredible period where they have dragged themselves so far clear that it didn't really matter how the season ended. And those 2 losses didn't really affect them and they weren't pulled back towards that relegation zone. So The job that Corberan has done, you know, you might look at the table and say, oh, Valencia finished 12th. You know, that's nothing to really write home about. But actually, from where they were to how they finished the season and how they turned things around and how they looked under Corberan, I just thought he deserved a little bit of some flowers.
That's actually quite funny that of all the stories that we've seen this season, all the cup winners and all the first timers and the trophy droughts ending and Liverpool winning the league, Napoli doing it, all this fun, and we've both picked stories where neither team actually won anything. They've kind of come back from situations where they've proved people they were not as bad as everybody thought they were. We need a playoff between Nottingham Forest and Valencia to see who's the true great story of the season.
Well, that would be nice because also that's a Nuno Espirito Santo derby, right, as well? because he managed at Valencia for a year.
Well, I'm going to say it must have been a brief spell. Everyone's had a turn of managing Valencia at this point.
I think it was all 2014 kind of way. You know, before he went over to Porto. So, you know, it's one of those. It'd be a special game for him as well. But yeah, look, obviously the stories, you know, Palace and Newcastle and Bologna.
A
bit about Bologna, you know, later on. But, you know, I think it is sometimes these stories that go under the radar. You know, there's been plenty of coverage on a lot of those stories.
But it's also week on week. Like, this is what you live week by week of the season. And like, you know, yeah, the Spurs winning Europa, it's a great story, but it's like, let's be honest, it's like one day really, because like getting to the final wasn't that difficult, it turned out, in the end in the Europa League. And like, Palace was a great story, but until you get to the semi-finals, it's not really something that's coming together. And so it's like a short period of the season that's really exciting. And, you know, for us sat here every week and living through the season and watching it all unfold, I think maybe we just have a bit more depth in terms of when we consider this, because we've been kind of studying how these teams have actually been through it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Anyway, shouts out to Valencia. Shouts out to Nottingham Forest. Yeah. Some of the best stories that might have gone a little bit under the radar that we just wanted to give some flowers to. But speaking of flowers, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to get stuck into some of these awards. Make sure you stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Ranks FC, where it's time to hand out some awards. And we're going to start by doing Player of the Season. So, Dean, I'm going to hand it to you to do the Premier League 3-2-1. I might have some arguments with you. And then after that, we'll go to Europe to see if we can pick out three players from there as well. So, floor is yours, Mr. Jones.
I mean, the problem is with Premier League Player of the Year, there's literally not a debate. I mean, it's Mo Salah is the number one, and there's no point even building up towards that. It's kind of trying to decide whether he had a contender at any point for this award. Salah's had a great season, and obviously is taking home all of the plaudits and all of the actual awards and winning Footballer of the Year and things like that. And a season in which he's inspired Liverpool to win the Premier League trophy and now had the chance to celebrate that moment. He's not just scored 29 goals in the Premier League, he's also managed 18 assists along the way. It's a hell of a lot of goal contributions to the way of doing that. And there's surely no debate. The only thing I would say is, like, has Salah like had me on the edge of my seat? Has he amazed me as maybe former players of the year have? No, but that doesn't really matter. Like, in the here and now, with what we've got, Mo Salah has outperformed everybody in terms of being game-defining, being season-defining, being a talisman, being a man for the big moment, and coming through periods of the season when his team needed him and he got the goals.
Yeah. I mean, you also just spoke about that week-to-week thing, right? Like, there was that period early in the season where Salah was simply unplayable, right? Like, that was the period where Liverpool took the advantages they never, ever relinquished in terms of the Premier League title race. But that, you know, scorching start to the season where he burned through almost everyone was incredible to witness.
Yeah.
Just because the second half of the season has had a little bit of a tail off, and especially towards the end of the season with Liverpool kind of winning the trophy and then not really doing anything else across the course of the last couple of games. Like, recency bias comes into that, but that shouldn't take away from what Salah did, you know, over the course of this and what he's put together. The goal contributions, the most ever in a 38-game season, the way that he has led this Liverpool side, the way that he has been the main man, the talisman again, and then signed the contract. And now it all feels like this culmination of things that, you know, just because the season ended differently doesn't take away from the fact that he achieved so much over the course of the year.
Exactly that, yeah. So between like game week 8 and game week 20, which ran through October through to Jan, Salah scored at least one in every single game except against Fulham when they drew 2-2 against us. But also weighed in with loads of assists during that period as well. Like over that period, like 9-10 assists during that time as well. And like such a time when you're just like game, game, game. And obviously we had the international breaks, which kind of broke the season up a bit. It was very, very weird at stages this season as well. But Salah was always there. And Liverpool were never losing. They were like through that period, just not losing any games. They obviously were beaten by Nottingham Forest pretty early on. But then they just had this consistency, and Salah was yeah, absolutely pivotal to it all. So I think the only top contender for him would probably be his teammate Virgil van Dijk. I think because you usually look to the title winner, or you know, if obviously sometimes you have a very close title race and it can go the other way, but typically it's the title winner that wins the Player of the Year. And you always stray towards the forward players to actually win it because they have such game-defining highlights reels that you can judge them by. But Van Dijk's been extraordinary. And again, in a season when his contract was up in the air, his future was up in the air, he was always the one that I was like, they can't lose him. They can't lose. They can lose Trent. They can get by without Salah. You can't get by without Van Dijk. And he was just, yeah, well, he's a colossus, isn't he? He's absolutely, he's just a wall. And he was back to his brilliant best. So I think that he would probably come second in a ranking. And then third, I mean, I'd probably throw out a few names and they'd all be for different reasons. I think I'd throw Declan Rice into the mix just because of he took his game forwards again. And obviously if you were to count European football, then obviously he had the Real Madrid game, which was literally one of the standout games of the whole season and an unbelievable, perhaps career-defining performance for him personally. So I think that that's important. Then you get players like Eze, who obviously delivers Crystal Palace a trophy. You get players like Alex Isak, who definitely deserve to be mentioned in that kind of situation. And then even, you know, Brian Mbeumo goes and scores 20 goals again. Well, not again, but 20 goals for Brentford. And it's like, he's consistent again, is what I was trying to get at. Like, this guy is bang, 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 bang. Every season gets better, gets better, gets better. And it doesn't really count for much at the end of the day. But I think he probably would deserve a mention of getting onto that third step of the podium as well.
Murillo as well, and Nottingham Forest. Like, I think you can kind of look at that and be like, that has been absolutely exceptional and part of the reason they've got to where they've got to. I think Moise Caicedo has had an absolutely sensational season for Chelsea. I think you're right. There is such a gap from the top two downwards. And everyone else feels like, I know we just talked about Salah having a drop off towards the end of the season, but it kind of feels like everyone had brilliant half season. Like Berrettini has been absolutely sensational in 2025. Yeah. But the start of the season was really poor from a Palace perspective. And I know there are reasons for that and there are mitigating factors and all of those things. That's fine. But like, it feels like the way that he stepped up in 2025 was the bit that was truly really remarkable. And I think you could probably point to a lot of players in terms of, you know, how consistent have they been over the course of a season. And Salah and Van Dijk stand head and shoulders above the rest, I think, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. And I think Salah will rightly get the plaudits as the player of the season in the Premier League. I think it's interesting, though, because we obviously had the Ballon d'Or episode a couple of weeks ago. And so when I was doing my player of the season bit here for Europe, there was a lot of the same names coming up. And I think there's a slight difference in this in terms of what you're looking for and what you're looking at. And for that reason, I think, you know, you just spoke that forward players tend to get the plaudits. I think that this is not necessarily the same as a Ballon d'Or ranking because you have to take different considerations into account. And when we were doing that, we were talking about who do we think were actually the favorites to win it, not necessarily who do we think should win it. And so doing this, I've been able to just be a little bit freer with it. So, you know, Ousmane Dembele has been absolutely sensational at PSG, but a little bit like Berrettini, the kind of glow up in 2025 from where he was towards the start of the season. You'll remember that he was left out of the PSG squad to play Arsenal at the Emirates in the league stage of the Champions League. You know, that didn't work really as much until we got to 2025 and something just clicked and he went into this just kind of monster mode that no one's been able to stand with. Like, so you kind of look at it and I had him in this mix. I had Rafinha and Lamine Yamal in this mix. And I don't know where they land, but I've decided that I am going to give this one to Pedri in a way that I couldn't give in the Ballon d'Or because I don't think Pedri is going to win the Ballon d'Or. Mm-hmm. I do think that he has been the absolute fulcrum of a Barcelona side who have been truly magnificent to watch. Seeing him play over the course of a full season without injury concerns, without the constraints, and given the freedom to absolutely run this team in Hansi Flick's system, he has been an absolute delight. And I think that without him, if you pull him out of that Barcelona team, they suffer the most. And considering where they've been and considering how they've got to where they've got to this season, that's enough, I think, for me. You just said it about Van Dijk, right? As in, if you take him out of that side, does the house of cards come crumbling down? I think with Pedri and Barcelona, he is the player that has the biggest effect when he's not on the pitch. And for that reason, I think that in all of these brilliant names and in all of these brilliant kind of performances over the season, and all of these players deserve flowers, it's going to be Pedri for me, who I put down there as a player of the season for the rest of Europe.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, he's got that adaptability about him whereby he's either kind of setting the tempo of a game or making recovery runs, winning recovery balls. But he's just so trustworthy. And now that he's managed to regain, well, he was injury free, like the regaining that fitness, it just meant that Barcelona could be themselves again, because they were like, oh, we're good. He's still here. He's not getting injured anymore. He's still here. And he's not just here, he's running things. And
well, you mentioned that, right? Like, you talk about those kind of elements of his game. That I think has been the kind of step up. Now, Pedri was always brilliant, right? Like, we're not going to sit here and be like, oh, Pedri wasn't good before and now he's unbelievable. Like, he was always a wonderful footballer. But in terms of what he's being asked to do in this system, yes, he sets the tempo, but the ability and the range of passing that he has, that kind of nous to be able to take a second and pick the right pass, the switch of plays that we've seen, the balls in behind for runners, you know, they play differently when they have a Ferran Torres up front as opposed to a Robert Lewandowski. Doesn't matter. Pedri's still there. He just plays in a different way, or he picks out a different pass when these things are happening. The recovery, as you said, he's added like almost the dog of Gavi into his game. He's gone like, oh, okay, cool. I can do that as well. The recoveries have gone up. You're talking about a player who literally now does everything in this Barcelona team. And I think that in a year where he won't get the flowers at the Ballon d'Or that he probably deserves, I'd be absolutely stunned if Pedri ends up on the podium at the Ballon d'Or, even though I think he deserves it. I wanted to give them to him here.
Yeah, he's only 22. Like, this is the other thing. He plays and we talk about him like we expect this from him. And, you know, typically he could still count as like young player of the year. You know, most young player awards count 22 and 23-year-olds towards winning an award. And yet, Pedri is way beyond that now. Like, he's tried and tested. He's a man, and he plays like a man.
Yeah, absolutely. Composure of a veteran is probably the phrase that I would use. All right, then, let's move on to some coaches, shall we? And let's go manager of the season.
Again, I don't think there's much doubt about this one, but I'll come up with a little tier system. At three, I've got a surprise. Ange Postecoglou.
I wondered if you'd do this.
Well, I mean, he's actually delivered what he said he would. So if you were to judge someone by the standard set, he's met it. And I've never seen anything like this. Like, obviously, it's been an appalling season in the league and the amount of games they've lost is ridiculous and all of those things. And they've been a meme club for half the season. He's argued with his own fans and he's been, you know, talked about as being a clown in press conferences and had to defend himself. And he says he'll win a trophy in his second season. And he goes and does it. He doesn't just win the Carabao Cup. He wins the Europa League, like a properly coveted trophy, and beats Man United along the way, who are in a similar boat, but were the favourites for the game. Almost everyone was backing Man United to win that final. And look, obviously it wasn't a good final, but he's come out on the right end of it. So I'm giving it to Postecoglou because he said, I mean, if we believe what he says and he was able to forsake the Premier League because he decided that this was the way to save the season and this is the way they were going to win silverware because he believed they could win it. He's done it. So there you go. So I've got him at three. I've got Eddie Howe at two. I think that the job that he's done is two-sided, really. One, to obviously win a cup for Newcastle and not just win a cup, but to beat Liverpool in a cup final. And the way he coached them through that final and the decisions that he made in that final, got it all bang on. All bang on. And at a time when he came into the season under some pressure, is he capable of lifting this club to where the ownership expect them to be? You know, they want to try and win the Premier League. They expect to be in the Champions League. They don't expect to lose Isak. They want to be signing like bigger players than Isak, all of these sorts of things. And could he keep up with that? He delivered a trophy and finished in a Champions League spot. Like, I think you've got to hand that to him. So he, for me, comes second. And Arne Slot has to go in as number one, has to be coach of the year. he's taken over from Jurgen Klopp. Nobody, Liverpool players included, and they've kind of intimated this when they've been asked about it in hindsight of the season. Did you foresee this? Did you think the manager could do this? And they're pretty adamant that no. Klopp was so hard to take over from. He was so infectious. He was so in love with the club and so knew what it took and was so close to winning something. And Slot comes in with a completely different personality, isn't very well known, in comparison at least, and without making a proper signing in the transfer window, goes and wins the league easily. Like, it's crazy. It's crazy how he's walked this league. And now, on the back of it, they're like, yeah, cool, you are pretty good. Do you want Florian Wirtz in here as well? Who else do you want? Frimpong? Who else do you want? Kirkit? What else do you need? We'll give you everything. If this is how good you are after 1 year, what are you going to do after 10? So I personally think that it's absolute no-brainer. Arne Slot is the coach of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult to argue with it. Like, but I was talking about this on the radio the other week, and we were kind of discussing the idea that you could probably make a case for like 10 Premier League managers to be in this podium. And, you know, you're looking at how this is shaken out. And okay, we have to kind of include all competitions in this. But, you know, and Arsenal fans aren't going to be like, Mikel Arteta is the coach of the season. But equally, you know, they did get to a Champions League semi-final where they were narrowly beaten by a very, very good PSG team. And you come into that and you're like, okay, the expectations were to go and potentially, you know, be at the very least closer challengers for the Premier League title. They end up 10 points back from Liverpool. But, you know, the steps forward remain, I think. And whilst we can talk about the fact that Arsenal need to get over the line, that's still been impressive. You could probably make a case that Enzo Maresca has fulfilled his brief, especially if he goes and wins the Conference League. He would have won a trophy and taken Chelsea back into the Champions League spots, which was basically his, you know, modus operandi this season. That was the goal, and they've achieved it. Newcastle, you've obviously already pointed out. Villa had an incredible Champions League run. They've come up a little bit short in the race for Champions League football again next season, but Unai Emery has shown his worth once more. Nuno Espirito Santo probably should be in these conversations because we're talking about it in a different kind of light. And yes, they've got to the Conference League in the end, but we were speaking at the start of the episode about how that achievement is massive within itself, and the way he coached this Forest side for most of it. You look at, you know, Brighton and Fabian Hertzler, who's had a very good first season, even if they've ended up coming just short of those European places. Bournemouth have got a record points total in the Premier League. Brentford have got a record points total in the Premier League. Fulham have got a record points total in the Premier League. Crystal Palace have won the FA Cup, and the one I would have in my three definitely is Ole Glasner, who turned that season around in a remarkable, remarkable fashion and has achieved what no other manager in Palace history has achieved in terms of winning a major trophy. And I think, you know, maybe you go down there, but like Vitor Pereira has turned Wolves around and been very impressive in the second half of this season. And as you say, you know, is already in your shortlist for winning that trophy. At what point do you go, wow, this has been an incredible campaign from a lot of wonderful managers? I think I would have Glasner in the top three. I think that is my only bugbear with where you're at. I think that Palace going and winning the FA Cup potentially carries slightly more weight for me than Newcastle getting to the League Cup and ending the Champions League.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I would have agreed if Newcastle didn't beat Liverpool. And the manner
as an individual coaching performance, I don't think there's much better than the League Cup final from a Newcastle perspective. Like, as an individual, which game was the best coach? The way that he nullified that Liverpool team in that game was truly exceptional. But arguably, you could make a similar point about Glasner in the FA Cup final. He got it absolutely spot on in terms of what they achieved. So, like, I take your point, but I think I'd have Ole Glasner in there if I was you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, I'm not going to play down what Glasner's done this season because it's extraordinary, and we've seen him take Crystal Palace to Wembley twice in a semi-final and a final. And, you know, they've obviously beaten one of the best teams in the country too in order to win their silverware. But yeah, it's all interesting, but none of it sees off Slot, who's seen off everyone.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with that. Let's come on to Europe. And obviously, there is a big two battling here, and it's Hansi Flick and Luis Enrique. I've given it just to Luis Enrique. I think the Lucho's job at PSG this season, the football that they play, and losing your star man, losing what you know many consider to be the best player in the world, and taking this team to a whole new level has been incredibly impressive. I think, look, you can make a case obviously for Hansi Flick as well and what he's turned around at Barcelona. But, you know, considering that we talked a lot about Barca this season, I think that Luis Enrique deserves his flowers here. Now, we're obviously recording this before the Champions League final, but last weekend, PSG comfortably ran out winners in the French Cup final against Stade Reims. And, you know, that means that this season they're on for a potential quadruple at this point. Yeah. And what he has done here with this football team, the way that he has unlocked certain players, the way that he has unlocked Ousmane Dembele in particular, but the balance of the midfield. We saw Bradley Barcola step in here for the final and, you know, score twice. If and you're giving Kvyat Kvaratskhelia a rest for once. He's like, oh, okay, Barcola's just going to come on and run the show. Well, he's got out of his fullbacks, you know, Nunez and Achraf Hakimi, who I think are probably the best fullback combination in the world, is remarkable. I think what we've seen from them in the Champions League and basically over the course of the season, obviously they didn't end invincible, which at one point they looked like they were going to. But when the big games have come, PSG have stepped up. They have played with such grace, such style, such finesse, the way that they can mix things up and go direct at times. They can play on the counter. They can suffocate you. What he has achieved with this team and the balance he has brought to this squad, you know, they lose a superstar, but they gain one in terms of the man on the bench is now the center of this PSG universe. And after years of it being name after name after name on the back of the shirts, it finally feels like a team. And look, you've said it before on this podcast, but this PSG side is so likable. You know, for years, the idea of like neutrals liking PSG was an absolute fantasy, right? Like it was the names on the back of the shirts, fine. Yeah. Would they be fun to play with on FIFA? Absolutely, 100%. But in terms of what they looked like on the pitch, they were very, very hard to like. But this is a likable PSG unit and it all comes from the manager. So Luis Enrique, for me, European coach of the year. I don't think that, I'm sure there'll be Barcelona fans screaming, what about what Hansi Flick has done? What about the turnaround he's had? But I think for me, Enrique pips it. Just as an aside, the man I had at number three was Vincenzo Italiano at Bologna, who I think has done a stunning job. You know, coming in there on the back of Thiago Motta setting records and getting Bologna back in the Champions League, he had a really tough start. They really struggled in the Champions League, but they have found their rhythm. And yes, the last couple of games since the Coppa Italia final, it has felt like everyone is just incredibly hungover and they've slipped down the table a little bit towards the end, but it was job done, right? And they're back in Europe next season. They'll be playing Europa League football, which is going to be very interesting. This is a team who lost, you know, their star striker in Joshua Zirkzee, who lose their centre-back in Riccardo Calafiori and the manager who guided them back to the Champions League. And Italiano has stepped in and, yes, it took a little while to make things tick, but he has gone and delivered a trophy for the first time in nearly 50 years. And Bologna was the place to be, the greatest party in the world for a couple of days this season. And that in itself, I think, is enough to lift him into this conversation as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, really nice stuff. Really nice stuff. Are we doing one more section or are we going on to a break?
No, let's do club of the season, okay. Shall we?
Yep.
So you can start in the Premier League.
I find this quite hard. There are really four teams and we've really kind of discussed them already on here. The four teams that you could put forward, in my opinion, for club of the year, Nottingham Forest, for the reasons I kind of outlined at the beginning. And then Newcastle and Crystal Palace because of their cup triumphs. And then Liverpool because of the way that they've won the league. And I don't know how you really separate them all necessarily as clubs, but I think that Liverpool, no matter what you were to do, Liverpool would come out on top. And I think there are various aspects as to why. And first and foremost, like undisputed champions, like blew everyone out the water. Like, that we were supposed to have a title race this season and they weren't expected to win it. They were expected to be in a title race. They weren't expected to go and blow everyone out of the water.
I don't know if they were even expected to be in a title race.
Maybe not.
They were expected to be in the fight for the Champions League.
Yeah. You know, if they'd have finished fourth this season, no one would have really thought anything of it. But, you know, they toyed with teams. It was like, it was too easy for them at times. And so they delivered in a way that nobody expected. Anfield seemed louder than it seemed in a long time. Like, it's always loud. But even the decibel levels around Anfield seemed to go up. And they were able to cruise in the end through the final month or so of the season with a title in the bag. They done it with a swagger. And they didn't have to worry about derby games. They didn't have to worry about clashes against rivals. Like, none of it fazed them, really. And even if they were to come out on the other side, on the wrong side of it, they'd have been like, doesn't matter. We're better than everyone in this league, which is remarkable because they didn't sign anyone. Chiesa. Okay, they signed Chiesa, who didn't really play. But everything else was just kind of left. And you get like Ryan Gravenberch emerging as one of the players. I didn't talk about him earlier, but Gravenberch had a brilliant season, transformed in positionally, transformed in terms of the trust levels of his teammates and also the supporter base. So that was remarkable. Then you've got the Mo Salah story, where I assume they made some sort of documentary about him across the last season. I don't know, but I'll be amazed if we're not seeing some sort of documentary on Mo Salah and what he achieved. It was like record all through the season at this club.
There was a joke at one point going around that, you know, the amount of records he was breaking, they were going to rename Opta Joe to Opta Mo. It was just Salah record after Salah record after Salah record after Salah record.
And it was fitting, right? So there's all of that. And then you've got the whole club side of it. And the fact that Liverpool are Liverpool again. And, you know, we didn't live through their glory days. We didn't see what those were, but we've heard plenty about it. And we've seen signs in our lifetimes of why Liverpool are huge and how they can win trophies. You know, they've always won trophies, but they've not quite become the dominant force. And I think that this season, the reason I would make them club of the year is because they now have an opportunity to become the dominant force in English football, which after 1 year of a new manager, a team that we thought needed like beefing up in three or four positions and didn't get it and still won the league. And now they're going to go into the transfer market, blow that apart. The atmosphere has been unbelievable. They just feel completely rejuvenated, but also have this swagger about them. And I haven't really seen Liverpool fans like this. As I say, I've heard about it. I've seen Man United fans act like this. I've never actually seen Liverpool. They've always believed, obviously, they're the biggest club in the world, or certainly in England. But did they believe that they could go and win year after year after year? Now, I think we've got that. I think that's just been unlocked. And so I think that certainly takes them above those other teams there that I've talked about as what I would consider as being candidates, because they're all in the shadow of this great, huge club.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And look, it's obviously slightly contrived is the wrong word, but like obviously Liverpool are dominating these awards, right? Like in terms of the Premier League element of it, but that's how good they've been, right? Like that's how good they've been compared to everyone else. I think Nottingham Forest probably come in there second for me, and Palace third is probably how I would look at it in terms of what they've both achieved. Just in terms of consistency over the course of the season and some of the things we've seen from Forest, considering, you know, last year they were very much relegation candidates. Yes, there were, you know, other things off the pitch that were affecting that, but relegation candidates to European football is truly stunning, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, Palace, you know, breaking their trophy duck in itself, the way that they went about that, the business they kind of stood to. And, you know, we talked a little bit recently about managers standing on business. You talked about Ange Postecoglou, you know, saying that and then backing it up. Coldest moment in Premier League managerial history, perhaps, being like, no, this is what happens. But like Glasner did this too, right? Like Glasner being like, Pep plays like that again, I will beat him. We'll work it out. True. And then he did. And then he did. These are the kind of statements you make. This is the quality and caliber of the clubs we're talking about. And I think that Palace probably go in there, and, you know, their incredible support, the finals, the TIFOs, all of that. We're talking about the club as a whole. That's where it gets very special for me. I've had my top two as well. It's felt like a Barcelona and PSG off, really. And they were top two in this as well. But I've given the nod to Barcelona this time. Mm. And I think, you know, I liked what you said there about a lot of those things. But the thing that highlights this Barcelona team is obviously they've gone through some major difficulties. They saw Real Madrid win a La Liga Champions League double last season and then sign Kylian Mbappe, who, as we said, you know, many consider the best player in the world and who has had a stonking season in his own right. He's going to win the European Golden Shoe over the course of his first season in a year where people were, you know, questioning whether he actually fit or not. Now, that question isn't fully answered, but I think that the amount of goals he has racked up suggests to me that there is no way on earth you could consider this a bad season from his perspective. And what do Barcelona do? Well, they promote from within. Yes, they make a couple of signings that change things. Obviously, we see Wojciech Szczesny join on a free, and Dani Olmo is the big one that comes in the summer. You know, that's the money they spend. But I was looking at the squad and I was like, of players that, you know, play regularly in this team, how many of them are homegrown or were brought in young to La Masia? So you're talking about Pau Cabarsi, Alejandro Balde, Gavi, you know, Ferran Torres, who obviously came in from Valencia, then left, and then obviously went to Man City and came back. But Ferran probably comes into this camp. Pedri comes into this camp. Ansu Fati hasn't played very much, and it looks like he's off to Monaco. But again, another homegrown talent. You know, Iñaki Peña in there, Pablo Torre, Fermi Lopez, Marc Casado, Lamine Yamal, who we've really not spoken about very much, Eric Garcia in this camp. And, you know, you look at the players from the younger sides who have got minutes over the course of this season. Marc Bernal obviously was important until he had that season-ending injury, which was a shame. But, you know, Hector Fort has played a lot. Gerard Martin was brought in a little bit older, but he has had, you know, a major effect on this season as well. You look at the names that they're kind of reading out there, that's like two-thirds of the squad that was either homegrown or brought in before the age of 18. To do that and do what they have done this season with that amount of talent coming through the pipeline. Yes, it's been forced in a way by the financial situation that they have found themselves in. But in terms of putting together a team that Barcelona fans can fall in love with again in a year where they do not play at their home stadium because it's being, you know, reconstructed in its own right, you're looking at a team who have been through the ringer in terms of pulling out levers and doing all these things to try and work their way out of financial peril. And they turn to this youth pipeline and it delivers in a way that has been truly, truly remarkable. So I think that they get the nod from me because of that. Interestingly, the team that I have third here is Sporting, who completed a League and Cup double at the weekend over Benfica by winning the Taça in extra time. They score I think it's 100th minute equaliser from the penalty spot, and then they go on and they tear them apart in extra time. So a double for them. And I think that for me, the reason that Sporting go into this category is because they lose their manager, a generational manager for them in Ruben Amorim, the man who had turned everything around. And at that moment, the house of cards comes crumbling down. While Pereira is put in charge, they look absolutely dreadful for 2 months. They fall completely off the pace. They crash out of European competition. They lose all of the vim and vigor that had been associated with the Amorim era. And then they bring in Rui Borges from Vitoria, and he turns things around. He goes on this absolutely remarkable run of results over the second half of the season that ends with them pipping Benfica to the title by 2 points and then going and winning the cup as well. And to achieve that in a year where everything was completely up in the air, where it looked like everything was crumbling apart, what he's put together there, I think, is absolutely incredible. So I'd have Sporting in there in third. As much as I love the stories of Celta Vigo and what they've achieved, I kind of wanted to spread it out a little bit. Mm. And I wanted to give Sporting some flowers because the turnaround under Hoiberg and the way that they have found themselves again and refound their mojo, got that, you know, looking like they are the team that are going to dominate again, that this kind of becomes eras and these big, big moments. That, I think, is truly incredible. So I've got to give them some love.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Yeah, no, I like the way that you've covered that ground. And yeah, and Barcelona, I think, you know, he's talking about, you know, giants who have kind of been reborn there, and Liverpool over in England and Barcelona and Spain. And these clubs, they just rise again. And it's funny because this week, obviously, you hear figures attached with Man United talking about how, you know, we'll never die. We'll be back. We'll always be back. We'll always be back. And at this point, and with Man United, you're like, will you? Will you? And then you got to believe, because, I mean, neither of those clubs have been down to the kind of depth Man United are right now. But the big clubs do tend to find their way back, and sometimes when you least expect it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, talking of Man United, we're going to do letdown of the season after the break. Make sure you stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back for the third and final time to this episode of Ranks FC. We have two more awards to hand out each. Letdown of the season and signing of the season. Let's start with the negatives, Dean. Over to you.
Yeah. Let's start with the letdowns of the season. At three, you might not remember this guy, João Félix. Remember him?
I do remember him. He's going to feature in mine as well.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, that makes sense, because what on earth happened? Obviously, like, completes this permanent deal to Chelsea on a 7-year contract. By Christmas, they don't even want him anymore. He's loaned out. Disastrous season for João Félix yet again. Has to be talked about in England as a complete flop and a letdown. So I'll leave that there, seeing as you've got him on your list as well. At number two, very sad to see this guy on this list, but it's Phil Foden. What a letdown. Like, what has happened to Phil Foden? His goal contributions took a 60% hit this season. That's how far down he was. Last season, he got 40 goal contributions. This season, he got 16. He's 24 years old. This is a guy that was talked about as a generational talent in English football. There was Paul Gascoigne. There was Wayne Rooney. There's Phil Foden. That kind of bracket is where Foden is. And we've seen it. He was Footballer of the Year a year ago. We were talking about him in the same terms that we're talking about Mo Salah right now. Yet we're not talking about Salah, who's in his 30s and winding down. We're talking about Foden, who's in his early 20s and coming to life and a completely integral part of what they are building under Pep Guardiola, and four successful seasons in a row under Guardiola. And then obviously he has a tough time of things with England on a personal level, because he struggles to accept or take the criticism that comes of him as he fails to ignite England's attack at the Euros. Carries that form into the new season and doesn't really feature in the early season for Man City. He's very limited in how much we see him. And it's not until the new year, in January, Phil Foden finally comes to life in the Premier League. Four games in a row: West Ham, Brentford, Ipswich, Chelsea. Goal, two goals, two goals, one goal. You're like, oh, he's back. Phil Foden's alive. That was it. There was no more goals and no more assists for the rest of the season. His last goal or assist for Manchester City in the Premier League was the 25th of January against Chelsea. And we got to the point, you know, final few games of the season, Man City play Wolves, he gets 6 minutes. Then Bournemouth didn't get off the bench. Fulham, away last game of the season, got 8 minutes. What's happened? What's happened? It's quite sad, but it's also a letdown. So a tough story, but one you have to highlight. And See whether
it's been back. So difficult. Like, also, I was looking at this the other day because I was like, what has happened? He's played the lowest amount of minutes in the Premier League since the 2020-2021 season, where he was a 20-year-old breaking through, right? And even in that season, he only got 100 less minutes than he did this season. Now, part of that is obviously that the start of the season and not really seeing him in terms of actually being in the lineup. But that is a major, major issue. The fact that he has his kind of minutes contribution, his goal contribution has obviously dropped off, as you say, but the minutes contribution dropping off to this extent as well, you know, to the point where he's getting, you know, fewer minutes than when he was a 21-year-old. He's getting fewer minutes than, you know, when he was breaking through. That is terrifying, I think, from a Foden perspective. And you look at it now and you're thinking, okay, Omar Marmoush has come in. He's done really, really well. Man City are going to strengthen in the summer. They're going to look for players in these wide areas. You know, Marmoush is going to be the go-to guy behind Erling Haaland. He's going to be the player that plays behind him in that number 10 role. And yes, perhaps Phil Foden steps back up and takes, you know, Kevin De Bruyne's spot, but you're talking about players linked with Manchester City, and we're talking about Tijani Reinders, and we're talking about Morgan Gibbs-White and all of these different elements of the equation. I do worry that, you know, this is going to be a really, really hard thing to break back in. And we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, right? That Phil Foden felt like he could be a one club man.
Yeah.
At this point, it feels like he might have to leave because it's got to that point. Now, maybe that's slightly over the top. And I'm sure there are City fans going rolling their eyes as they're listening to this. But I think we are at a point where you're like, if they go and buy 3-4 players who play in those kind of attacking midfield roles, where's the gap for him to kind of work his way back into the side? Because right now we're not seeing any of that from the performances.
Exactly, exactly. And I hope that next season we're talking about fight back stories and players that are undergoing a complete transformation in another sense, and that Phil Foden is number one on that list. Because at 24 years old, the guy can't be done. He can't be. Come on, Foden, prove to us that you shouldn't be a complete letdown. But unfortunately, I've got to judge you as I judge everyone else, and you are. But you're not the biggest letdown of the season, because the biggest letdown of the season is Ruben Amorim. I mean, okay, first of all, we'll give him the caveat of he's not got a great group.
Just in Manchester United.
So that's difficult, because, you know, if you've got Hoyland up front, then fair enough. You might struggle to score goals. But what has Ruben Amorim improved for Man United? And what have Man United got compared to what they thought they were getting? Like, this is a guy who, when they were signing him from Sporting, had an 88% win record, right? For the season. He'd won 16 out of 18 games coming in to United. He'd beaten Manchester City in resounding style, 4-1, Sporting battered him. Tactically, he was being lauded. He's brilliant. Man United get him. They're like, people, fans of other teams are like, oh no, they might be good. They might be good. Like, this guy's good. They scored 54 goals in his last 16 games at Sporting. They were getting 3.4 goals a game. He comes in and they play Ipswich and Rashford scores the first goal. You know, oh my God, he's even brought Rashford back to life. Like, wow, this guy could do it. Nah, he didn't do it. He's ended the season with a 23% win rate at Man United. They finished 16th in the Premier League. They're closer to relegation than making the European spots. They've conceded 41 goals, 1.6 a game. Only kept 4 clean sheets all season. They got one of the worst conversion rates in the division, second worst in the league, in fact. They get to a European final, a chance to kind of put a silver lining on a terrible campaign, and they lose to Tottenham. You can't lose to Tottenham. You're Man United. Like, you can't do it, lads. It's Tottenham, all that sort of stuff. And he did. He lost it. And not only did he lose it, it felt like his tactical mistakes, his selection mistakes, led to the defeat. And as a result of his errors, as a result of his failure to get more out of this Man United team, they are set back again in this transfer window, and not only cannot sign the players that they wanted or need to, but are probably going to take a hit by losing a player they didn't necessarily want to, whether that's a Fernandez or a Kobbi Mainoo or whatever. We'll have to wait to see. But all of the things that we were expecting, a better defensive record, more goals per game, a tactically better setup, we didn't get it. Instead, we had him commenting that this was the worst Man United team in history. That's where we got to.
At least he's honest.
At least he's honest. He's right. It is. But a complete letdown. A complete letdown, because he was supposed to be at least better than Ten Hag. So far, he's not.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are caveats, right? Like, and I'm a huge Amorim defender, and I appreciate that. And I'm going to come from that from a different kind of angle on where this is at. But yeah, there's no doubting it's been absolutely dreadful. I mean, look, I don't think he wanted to take over this job mid-season. I think that he definitely wanted to wait until the end of the campaign, and that obviously wasn't an option.
Maybe that's what he's doing, because he hasn't really.
Yeah, well, maybe.
I'll start next season.
Not in the summer. But, you know, whichever way you dress this up, it's been bad, right? Like, there's no getting around it. Yes, are the players not good enough? 100% the players aren't good enough. Like, are there enough players in there to actually play the system he wants? No. And there are elements of that where you go, well, maybe you adapt a bit more. I think he is trying to literally be like, no, I'm setting down the foundations and we build from here. United have to put their stock in someone. They have to put their faith in someone to make things work. And he seems to be that man for now. But, you know, I think he will have the benefit of the doubt over the course of the summer, but fans will expect a resounding improvement next year. And so far, we've seen nothing to really suggest that that's going to be the case. Now, I saw the side he turned around at Sporting, right? And I saw the absolute dumpster fire that the club was before he took over, and the way that he managed to reshape and remodel that club in his own image to the point where they became a winning machine, as you kind of correctly pointed out. But equally, we haven't seen anything of the sort at Manchester United. We haven't seen any sort of green shoots. There have been no sparks of life in terms of things that fans can cling on to. Yes, obviously, they go far in the Europa League. They have a much better time in European competition in terms of beating some of the you know, more impressive clubs in the tournament as well. You know, Athletic were a very good side. That Lyon game was loads of fun. But ultimately, they've all been false dawns. And now the pressure is on. I think, you know, you end the season 10th. If you end the season 10th and United get to a cup final, then I think they're like, okay, let's see what he can actually do. But the pressure now very, very much on Ruben Amorim to start next season well, or things are going to have to twist. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't keep working on this and being like, yeah, well, it's not completely my fault. I think up to this point, you can be like, there are caveats that suggest that there might be a different thing that comes in once United make the signings and shift the kind of philosophy of the club over. But you have to start that at the top. And so far, it's been pretty dreadful, I think. So there's not much more to say.
I don't think there is. Sorry, Ruben.
I've done letdown of the season slightly differently in that I've looked at it from a slightly more club perspective. Mm-hmm. But at three, I've gone with Real Sociedad, who have had a pretty dreadful season by their standards. Now, Imanol Alguacil has left the club. He basically said he's taken them as far as he can, and this season was pretty much a disaster from start to finish for him. Now, he's also one of the most successful managers in the club's history. We've seen some incredible sides and some incredible performances under Alguacil, and maybe it's just that an era has run its course at this point. But considering they were supposed to be in the conversation for Champions League football, to finish mid-table, to finish on the same points as the Valencia side we spoke about earlier on, who had a wonderful run in the second half of the season, but obviously had, you know, still were mid-table and winning the relegation zone when Corberan took over at the start of 2025. Real Sociedad to also have finished on 46 points, to finish 6 points below Rayo Vallecano in the final, you know, Conference League spot in La Liga, to finish behind Osasuna, who are the smaller of the clubs in the Basque Country in La Liga, to finish that far beyond Athletic Club. You know, they finished with like 34 points. That's an Athletic Club.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. Like, ridiculous considering where the two were. They were vying, they were battling, they were in and around each other. That kind of drop-off is remarkable, I think.
Yeah.
And what we've seen from Real Sociedad this year has just not been enough. Now, there are facets to this. There are caveats in terms of their spending and what's happened there. but not good enough from this group of players. And, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see how they kind of come on. They're promoting from within again in terms of who's going to be the manager next season, and whether they can bounce back or not is going to be a real question. You know, they were hammered in many ways by Manchester United in the Europa League. They didn't put up any sort of fight. And I've been really, really disappointed with how their season has gone. At two, I've gone for Porto, who have been a dumpster fire this season. There was so much excitement. I was in Porto last summer, obviously. And the excitement around the change of shape and the change of structure at the top of the club, André Villas-Boas coming in and becoming the president. And then it all started to unravel pretty quickly. And Sergio Conceição basically decided that it was over. They decided Villas-Boas that he wasn't going to keep him. He appoints his assistant. There is loads of bad blood between Conceição and the club, and his assistant just does incredibly badly in terms of how they went on this year. And they did sort of rectify. So for a while, it looked like they weren't even going to finish third. You know, that Braga were going to take them over and they wouldn't even get automatically into the Europa League stage. Mm. Now, they kind of rectified that towards the end of the season. But for a year where Sporting and Benfica, and look, I've given Sporting plenty of praise, but equally it hasn't been a vintage year in terms of like the way that Sporting ran away with it last year, the way that they just felt like they were always going to win the title. This was a year where all three of the big three in Portugal changed manager. This was an opportunity, and they have finished 9 points off the pace of Benfica, 11 points off the pace of Sporting. Yeah. They've lost 7 games in the league, which is more than Braga, and pretty much level with Vitória, who finished 6th. They have just been nowhere near good enough. And despite the fact that they bring in Samu, who has a very good opening campaign, you know, up front, and has been one of the few bright lights, it's been really, really poor. To end the season trophyless, to end the season outside the Champions League places again, it's just one of those years where they will look back at this and think, this has been ultimately a huge, huge disappointment from their perspective. So I've got Porto in at 2, and it's going to take some real turning around, I think, for them to become competitive at the top of the Primeira again. But the biggest letdown, I think, of the European season has been Milan, who have just not been up to it at all. Now, obviously, they make changes. They have a campaign where they end up with 2 different managers. Conceição is not coming out of this particularly well, is he? He comes in January, and he takes over from his countryman, Paulo Fonseca, who was pretty dreadful. There's an argument, I think, to say that Conceição was worse. Now, obviously, they win a trophy straight away under Conceição. And the kind of saving grace this season has been their performances against Inter, which is really weird in and of itself. But when you look at the players at their disposal, when you look at the way that they completely and utterly collapsed under the weight of their own pressure in the Coppa Italia final, when you take into account that they finished way off the European spots. And even then, their league position looks better than it actually was because Bologna just were drunk for the last 4 games of the season. Like, the lack of cohesion in this Milan squad with this team and this amount of ability in there is unbelievable to witness. Now, Christian Pulisic has had a pretty good campaign, I think, and seeing him really put it together this year has been one of the few bright sparks. But, you know, they signed Joao Felix, who you mentioned in your one, who barely registers in terms of making an impact. He scores his first goal for the club like 3 games before the end of the season, having signed in January. They have 3 strikers here in Santi Jimenez, Luka Jovic, and Tammy Abraham. And between them, they just can't really work out who's actually starting. Rafa Leão looks like he isn't interested anymore. Sami Chukwueze they were trying to sell in January and just ends up, you know, knocking around and looking like he's in the mix of this and thinking, why are you still there? What are you doing? Like, how are you still within this setup? And you look at, you know, the players in the midfield. You're looking at Musa and Fofana and Tijani Reinders, who's been excellent, Ruben Loftus-Cheek. You look at the players they signed, Strahinja Pavlovic, who I thought was going to be one of the signings of the season and has ended up kind of sidelined by this system. You look at Tomori in there. You look at the players that they've had at their disposal, and to watch them just completely and utterly all over on their face time and time and time again, it has been a disaster of a season for Milan. And I can't really look past them in terms of a team that I've been most disappointed by. I was so excited to see this team click. I was so excited to see this Fab Four together with Jimenez and Pulisic and Joao Felix and Rafa Leao. Hasn't worked. They've had to go to a three at the back system, which has been better, but still not great when you're kind of looking at it kind of across the board. And when you put all of that together, when you bring in a manager like Conte Sao, who felt like the kind of person who was going to actually drill in some sort of, you know, well, I suppose the answer is discipline to this team. The fact that they have ended the season like this is just absolutely nonsense. They are a huge letdown.
I can't even. They are such a letdown. I really want to get my kids AC Milan kits, but it's too embarrassing. Got to wait another year.
It's too embarrassing. What a fall from grace for the Rossoneri. Really, really, really poor. All right, Dean, last one. Let's do our signings of the season.
Yeah, I'll do mine pretty quick. In the Premier League at number three, Mikel Merino. Didn't think I'd be saying this, but... Well, I didn't think I'd be saying it for these reasons. He was signed as a midfielder who would like play alongside Declan Rice or whoever else was going to be in there and kind of unlock something new in that Arsenal midfield. Joins for £27 million and doesn't end up playing that position for most of the time at all. He becomes their new centre forward. And he helps them through a period of crisis when they're suffering bad injury problems. And by the end of the season, Jack, he's got more goals than Saka. He's got more goals than Odegaard. He's like, okay, he's only got 7 league goals and he's got 9 in total. But those goals were important goals. He was doing bits up there. And considering it was kind of the first time he played up there, we were mocking him a little bit. We were mocking Arteta for what he was doing. And then he kept sticking him up there. We're like, actually, he's quite good at this. So at number three, Mikel Merino, that was not exactly what he was signed for, but it was a great signing. Number two, at Nottingham Forest, Milenkovic joins for £12 million and like, what a signing. Like, who knows what Milenkovic and Murillo could go on to be, where they could play. The thing is, they found themselves in a really good setup at Nottingham Forest that really suited them, particularly this season. And Milenkovic, if you're looking for value for money, about as good as it gets. You know, you see top clubs throwing money around for centre-backs these days, and Forest have pulled a wonderful deal to get him through the door. And likewise, at number one, the best signing of the season was Dean Howson. I mean, what Bournemouth have done here, they've signed a sleeper, really, a player that was... had such a high ceiling and wasn't quite getting to live his best life. We were waiting for him to be fully unlocked. And he joined for like around £15 million as an under the radar player that had big potential. And he's leaving as a Galactico that Real Madrid is signing for £50 million and would have paid more than that, but he had a clause in there. They'd have paid more than that. He was a revelation in this team. The way this guy plays is just unbelievably calm. He reads the game brilliantly. He's deceiving because he doesn't look very strong, yet somehow he's competing with some of the most physical athletes in the world in terms of Premier League centre forwards. And then he's got the composure and the calmness to just play out the back, whether it's short, straight through the middle, angled or diagonal passes wide, like superb versatility to his passing range. And I just can't believe that I feel sorry for Bournemouth in a way that they haven't got more from him. Like, to only have a year of him seems quite sad, but he's been so good. They're just like, well, that's that. Like, they've probably known for months that he was going.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, making a £37 million profit on a player after one season is no small feat, right? But yeah, been amazing. And a big part of why Bournemouth was so excellent for much of this campaign, obviously it didn't end the way that they would have wanted it to, but you know, his impact as he came into this team, and the way that they then went on this remarkable run into contention for Europe, I don't think the two things are not linked. So I think that, you know, in terms of value for money, in terms of making a profit like that, you know, you take a player who was on loan at Roma, you know, Juve must be absolutely spitting feathers about this one, but it kind of is what it is. And he is now a Galactico, and I expect him to be at the heart of Real Madrid's defense for many, many years to come. That's how good he is, and it's, you know, it's good to see him get his flowers as well, because he's been stunning for Bournemouth. Just quickly across in Europe, I've gone 3 Michael Olise. Crystal Palace to Bayern Munich has come into that team and become a real fulcrum of creativity. He has slotted in seamlessly to one of the biggest clubs in the world. He has struck up wonderful relationships with Musiala and with Kane. He looks right at home there. And I think that what he's done in terms of Bayern getting back and winning the title, and how impressive and important he's been to their cause, is something that shouldn't go overlooked, even if it was a big sum of money. Another big sum of money, João Neves, Benfica to PSG, the missing part of the midfield. They sell Ugarte and they get João Neves in for a similar fee. They beat off competition from Manchester United, from loads of other big sides in Europe, and he has become one of the most important parts of one of the best teams across the course of Europe this season. And let's see if they finish that off with a Champions League win. But the way that he has come into that team and displaced Warren Zaire-Emery, who has given the balance to this team, the dynamo in the heart of that, that has made everything tick. He allows Vitinha that time on the ball. He has allowed Fabian Ruiz to get further forward and create. He just does a bit of everything, and I absolutely adore him. So I've put him in at number 2. But I think the best signing of the season, Dean, Scott McTominay, Manchester United to Napoli, a Scudetto winner, a man who has led from the front, who has been one of the main mans, who is called McFratum now in Napoli because he is so adored by the fan base, who is having his little shrines put up all over the city, in a team and in a place where they adore big characters. He has stepped up to become the kind of main guy and the focal point of this team. Obviously, there have been headlines, and I don't know if you've seen the videos of him having it off and having a big old party while chain smoking on top of a bus in Napoli. But incredibly enjoyable. The Lancashire Pirlo has become something else entirely. His relationship with Lukaku has been incredible, and he has been at the very heart of Napoli's return to the top of Italian football, to getting that Scudetto back, to Antonio Conte's version of what this Napoli is. Scott McTominay has been sublime, and I have loved watching him, given that freedom to get into positions of goal scoring. But he started clipping free kicks off bars. I was like, what's going on here? He's just started doing everything. And you know, he's in that kind of pantheon now of people in Naples who will be absolutely adored forever and ever and ever. And it's been wonderful to see, you know, someone who was, you know, at times made a mockery of at Manchester United, who was played out of position, who, you know, always gave everything, but was often kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time. To see him unlocked and unleashed in this manner has been an absolute delight. And I am delighted for him.
Yeah, I mean, done so well that Kevin De Bruyne has decided he wants to play with him in midfield. Nobody saw that day coming. You would not have predicted that a few years ago when they were going up against each other in Manchester. So, yeah, well done, Scott McTominay. An unbelievable season.
Absolutely, 100%. And with that, I think we're probably going to bring this podcast to a close. So all that's left for me to do is say thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC and our end of season awards. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. Thank you so much for listening as ever. Dougie and Sam will be back with the final episode of The Truth for this season on Friday, where they're going to be looking back at some of the best moments from across the course of this season as well. So make sure you're locked in for that one on Friday. But for now, from us, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you all shortly. Take it easy, Rank Squad. Peace.